and welcome to the Law is Cool podcast. Recently on our site, we've been covering the case of Ernest Zelkovich, a UWO student whose arrest was caught on tape and posted to YouTube. Allegations have been raised that the campus police used excessive force in the arrest, and the incident is now under review by a former OPP commissioner hired by the university. Today, we bring you a roundtable discussion featuring Zelkovich's lawyer, as well as a former police officer turned law student, and they'll be discussing that incident. But first, some really exciting news for all of us at Law is Cool. For the second year in a row, our site has been nominated in the Canadian Blog Awards. Now, this year, we've been nominated in five categories, including Best Group Blog, Best Professional Life Blog, Best Podcast or Vlog, and get this, Best Blog Overall. We also have four posts in the running for the Best Blog Post category, so it's very exciting news for all of us. Now, if you'd like to support Law is Cool, what you can do is visit the Canadian Blog Awards website, and you can actually vote for us. The first round of voting ends on December the 12th, then that will narrow down the nominees into a list of finalists, and the final round of voting will be from December 13th to 19th. So if you get a moment, head on over to the Canadian Blog Award website right now. Well, on to the topic of today's show, the arrest of Western student Ernest Zelkovich. Omar Haredi recently sat down to discuss the incident with Philip Millar and Ryan Venables.
We're here today with Philip Millar, who is a lawyer at Cohen Hiley in London, Ontario. He's going to be speaking to us today about Ernest Zelkovich, who is a student at the University of Western Ontario who had an unfortunate incident with the campus police there. I'm also here with Ryan Venables, who's a first-year law student at the University of Western Ontario, a former police officer in the York region and now going into legal training. So, Philip, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in this case first.
I guess I'll start with my background. I was in the Canadian Forces for 14 years as a combat officer. And because of some injuries, had to reclassify to lawyer and then went to law school at Western as a mature student. And those injuries resulted in me ending up getting a medical discharge from the military, and I just walked right into the Crown Attorney's office. And so for a couple of years, prosecuted criminals, and then I put my roots down in London because I traveled a lot in the military and had a family, and this firm recognized that they wanted to bring some trial experience that I'd gotten as a Crown, and so brought me over. And so now I do a little bit of criminal defense work at the higher end of the cases.
Okay. And I think what really brought this case to the public attention, or why it's become of somewhat so much interest to the public, is because of the YouTube videos that were there. Maybe you can describe what you saw in the YouTube videos and why this was of concern.
Well, most of your listeners have probably seen that video, and if they haven't seen it, I recommend they search YouTube and watch it and then come back to the podcast, because it's essentially it's a small clip of an incident that took place over considerably lengthier period of time, but it's a clip of the most serious part of the incident, in which my client was apprehended by police and put to the ground, and it appears, we haven't looked at it or taken it in front of a judge yet, but it appears to receive numerous and, in my opinion, excessive blows, strikes from fists, knees, and steel batons in an effort to subdue him. And I think everybody can watch it and come to their own conclusions. But it's at a minimum disturbing, I think, to most people who watch that video.
And how many officers were involved in the apprehension of the individual?
I was able to identify six on the video. I haven't got disclosure from the Crown Attorney's Office yet, which will reveal the statements of all the officers that were involved.
Okay. Now, Ryan, I know you've commented extensively on this as well in your blog posts.
Yes.
How do you feel as a former police officer? How do you feel about the type of force that was used?
You know, after going through the video, I have to say that through my training back with my former police service, as well as what I received at the Ontario Police College, for me, the biggest thing that stuck out was the baton strikes to his upper back. As I've mentioned previously, police officers are trained specifically not to target certain areas. The spinal column, head, forearms, things along those lines are more susceptible to injury with the baton. as opposed to major muscle groups such as like the quads or your upper shoulders and whatnot. And by targeting those areas, you can cause considerable amount of injury to a suspect during an arrest.
And so the individuals involved in the apprehension of the student would have known this then, presumably through their training.
Well, absolutely. You know, in order to carry certain use of force items, you have to be qualified, and you have to go through qualification training on a yearly basis. I'm not exactly sure how University of Western Ontario's campus police are trained. From my best recollection, they do their training with the London Police Service through a qualified use of force instructor, but... You know, going back to the video, I can only assume that if it were me as a police officer during that that instance, a baton, in my opinion, could have been used, or sorry, not used, and other options brought forth to deal with the arrest.
Now, the officers aren't here to speak for themselves, clearly, and then they all need an opportunity to speak. But the counter-argument I hear is that if somebody refuses to give their hand up for handcuffs, you can, you know, I've heard this from, is you can do whatever it takes to get that hand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that in some cases, but I think when it comes down to, like, charges that were laid against this client, like resisting arrest, if you got six guys pulling on you in every direction and you're getting strikes, like, there's somewhat of a natural... tendency to try to cover up where you're getting a strike, and if somebody has your hand, you know, it almost perpetuates the resisting, you know, and it just looked like a free-for-all as they piled on top, and you know, I understand it's difficult to get somebody under control, and that's where the training standards come into play, I imagine.
And Philip, you just came from court this morning, did you not, related to this issue?
Yes, I did.
And could you tell us a little bit about that and what happened?
Essentially, it was Ernest's first appearance after being released, and what we did is we adjourned the matter to, it's called Adult Therapeutic Court, and that's a court designed to deal with criminal charges that that mental health issues come into play from at the time of the incident. So it's a court that deals with capacity issues, criminal intent issues in a court system, because clearly if somebody's having some issues. In order to be convicted, you need to know what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
And this looks like it may be a case in which, you know, there was a stress breakdown in terms of our client, and he may not have known what was going on. I think if you listen to the video too, you hear him call out a couple times, like, "What's going on here? I don't understand."
Yeah.
That's muted under the overwhelming yelling of "Stop resisting!" But so that's the capacity issues are coming into play.
And Ernest was a student at the University of Western Ontario, and I think both of us can relate to the fact that there is an enormous amount of stress in the educational environment. Do you think that campus police or law enforcement officers are adequately prepared or trained to deal with issues of stress and how students, the type of situations students might find themselves in?
I can't speak to their training. I'm not familiar with their current standards of training. I just know that... I think that it's part, you know, you have an escalation of force procedure,
uh-huh.
And at some point you have to identify, like, what's going on with your target. You know, if there's a weapon present, you have to move quickly. If there's no weapon present, though, like, you want to assess what's going on, my friend.
I'm sure that the University of Western Ontario's campus police, I'm sure that they would have to have some sort of training in these sorts of situations. They work in very close proximity to, on any given day, 30,000 students that could be in and around the campus. So, although again, not familiar with what the standards are, you would have to hope and or assume that that some of these standards are definitely in place.
And it's interesting. Like, again, I'm speculating, but time of day comes into play. Like, if you're campus police in the evening around the campus bars, you know, you're used to a certain type of thing, but if you have an incident happening in the middle of the day, you need to assess it. And there are people who will say, well, what about, you know, the Virginia Tech incident and the Montreal, you know, and what I like to remind people in that say, those were people with automatic weapons, right? And yeah, the police needed to move very quickly in that case, but it doesn't, because you've had massacres at other universities, give license to people to be, you know, unrealistically forceful with students who...
And is it possible that, from a policy perspective, the pendulum has swung in too far in one direction in terms of heavy-handedness by the administration?
It's certainly possible. I'm not at the stage where I'm familiar with what their policy is. Like, mm-hmm. security on campus is a big issue. Security yeah. of the female population, of the whole population, of the professors, you know, and it needs to be addressed in a very serious manner by professionals.
Mm-hmm.
That policy will eventually come under scrutiny. But it doesn't mean that when you have somebody on the ground,
yeah.
that you now have leeway to start smoking them with a baton.
And I believe it actually is under scrutiny right now, right? I mean, it is mm-hmm. being investigated. There's a special investigation mm-hmm. to this issue. Maybe you can speak to that.
I'm not involved in that investigation. Okay. We haven't been asked to participate in it. I'll be very interested in the in their finding.
Okay. But it is being held. I believe they brought someone from outside, mm-hmm. right?
It's, former OPP Commissioner Gwen Boniface. Mm-hmm. She, after retiring from there, she was heading up, I believe it was Ireland's national police force. And correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not exactly sure of the dynamics there. But I believe that the Western's president asked her to come in and oversee an investigation, I guess, as an independent body to review the actions on that day.
And the university's behavior after the event seems very reasonable by all. Like, they allowed the demonstration or protest to happen on short notice. They look like they're bringing in honest brokers. They appear to and certainly soften the stance in terms of how they were going to deal with Mr. Zelkovic also, I think, as they get more information.
Now, would the case, I mean, the investigation, the findings from that would be useful, I'm assuming, for your client as well in terms of the proceedings? Could it be used in an evidentiary manner?
It may. It's a policy issue. Like, in a criminal matter, you can have a stay of proceedings because of police brutality, mm-hmm. to call it that. So if you have an example where somebody has been treated with excessive force, you can get a stay of proceedings. I don't think we're going to need to go there in this case. I think that because of the capacity issue at the time, that we're probably going to get, it's called diversion. So we'll go through a diversion program where he'll get assessed, and then as long as everything's successful, we'll likely see the charges go away.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the rally that was held in support of this individual. I think mm-hmm. Ryan had a couple questions related to that. You were present, was that correct?
I was actually present. You know, I just happened to catch myself between classes, and as I was walking through the University Community Center, found myself in the middle of the rally hearing my name being called out. Were you present?
Why was your name being called out?
Because I wrote a blog post
yeah.
about it, and it just more specifically in relation to the baton strikes, mm-hmm. and I think not only some of his supporters, but some of the Bosnian community picked up on that.
Yeah.
And I
was trying to get back to it. I was in Sarni in court that day, but I had all the news media contacting me that day, so I had to rush back and did some interviews, but I never got the rally was over before I got back.
There was definitely a large media presence there, but as well, there is, interestingly enough, when I was there, there was a segregated group of very outward anti-police segment there, so I wasn't sure if you were there.
I wasn't with that group, because as a past Crown attorney, I'm very pro police.
Right.
I play poker with a number of
as am I.
Outstanding right. Police officers in London. And whenever you have these demonstrations, you'll always have that kind of group that will immediately blame the police for everything, and then another group, equally as radical in my mind, who will excuse the police of everything. And so all of a sudden you get your encampments right away, and they make themselves known. It's usually those people in the middle who are asking the right questions that are the most worth listening to.
So, I mean, especially in terms of the Western community, it would be important to recognize that although this was an unfortunate incident, it doesn't characterize the entire Western community or even the Western campus police, and that they do play a very important function.
I've done some prosecutions of the Crown with the Western police, and they were very professional.
Now, is there any issues in terms of the terminology, Western, you know, campus police or campus security and things like that? I know it varies from school to school.
For me, you know, I know that although they may be called campus police, they're not actually police. And I don't want that to be taken in any kind of a negative way whatsoever. They're considered, they're special constables who are, from the best of my recollection, peace officers under the criminal code.
Yeah.
So although at Western itself, they would carry all rights as a normal police officer would, minus carrying a firearm.
And is it Section 25 and 26 of the Criminal Code then that empowers them?
Yeah, for use of force, yeah.
Okay.
You know, they would have to go through, as I mentioned previously, various training and they're able to use force within an arrest so long as it's within the guidelines of Section 25. And should it go over or they exceed their force, they can be held culpable via 26. Yeah.
So issues that come into play is powers of arrest. So a special constable on campus would have powers of arrest.
Okay.
Not necessarily they'd be limited off the campus, but on the campus property they'd have powers of arrest. My client was charged with resisting arrest. So because a lot of your listeners are in the legal community, the first thing you do as a lawyer is look, well, was there a legitimate arrest? Were there grounds for an arrest? Because if there weren't, the charge of resisting arrest becomes quite difficult to prove. It's actually impossible. So you need to know if there's an arrest. Interesting point is that you can't elicit an arrest for like a trespass issue unless there's a threat or something like that. So it's interesting how charges come out in the end. Like, he wasn't charged with trespass. He was charged with mischief under 5,000, and then resisting arrest, escape lawful custody, and assault. So you can see how the kind of charges flow. But we still don't really, we need to like find out exactly how it came to be that campus police were trying to get him out of there.
Okay, so we still don't know all the details right now.
No, like there's different sides of the story. I haven't read the police officer's statements or the other witnesses. I have my client's recollection of events.
And are you allowed to speak about how this may have impacted the student in terms of the future, his academic future?
I know right now there's some communications between him and the university. And I think at the beginning, the university, having dealt with them in the past and other matters, they're often very firm about, you know, you can no longer come back onto the campus, you're not welcome here, blah, blah, blah. That tune changed, I think, after they got more information and realized that this wasn't like some criminal doing bad things there. This was actually somebody in need of help who suffered an unfortunate incident.
Yeah. Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about in terms of this case?
I think the concept of the video is very interesting because, you know, I run into a lot of police officers and Crowns, and they all know me now that I've gone to they call it the dark side.
Me too.
But, and they say, oh yeah, you know what the problem with video is? And I say, what's the problem with video? They go, you don't know what happened before or after. And I said, that's an interesting point, but it's limited intellectually because it's not the problem with video. The good thing about video is that you actually know what happened in that window.
Yeah.
And for example, if you take I think it was Robert Tukansky incident in British Columbia.
Yep. The tasers.
Yeah. Absent a video, right, you would have had six police, you know, you would have had a bunch of police officers who corroborated their statements, right?
Yep.
The family might have been asking questions. They would have been told he presented a danger. You know, it would have been, everything would have been swept. There would have been no justice.
Yeah.
That video allows the justice system to come in and take a hard look at the behavior and say, during this, did this happen? And then, interesting enough, is you often find out other stuff. Because, and so what I say to people who question, we don't know what happened before. And it could have been very disturbing or it could have been not that disturbing. But the question everybody has to ask themselves, what happened during the video? Was that justified?
Yeah.
Right, and that's where it comes into the statements on the baton strikes and those types of things.
Well, I know as a police officer, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what happens before. It doesn't matter what happens afterward. Mm-hmm. It's a police officer has been trained to be professional throughout. You know, and you can't let just because this guy or whoever may have bumped by you and taken off. You know, you can't take that personally. It's just like if you see on any TV show or CNN or Fox TV covering pursuits in the States, you know, it's just because somebody has decided not to pull over for you in a pursuit, it doesn't give you the authority to thump them out after the pursuit's done and you get them.
There was an interesting point I wanted to talk about. It's just escaping me right now.
Well, we certainly are seeing a lot more cell phones.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
And I tell you, as a Crown, I've read the police statements, and as a defense attorney now, I've read the statements, and it definitely makes it very difficult for police to do their job sometimes, like, because, you know, you're getting a one perspective kind of view.
Mm-hmm.
This YouTube video was done, the main one was done by a sociology professor
Okay.
who specializes in crowd control. who very interesting man, and who will be, you know, spoken to when the case comes up. Obviously, doesn't want to be under the spotlight right now, and you know, you just said I was just videotaping it as a service to the public so they could see an unbiased view of what happened. And but the thing that your listeners should know, and anybody should know, is that there's a way, and I'm not sure because I'm not as functional on YouTube, is that he uploaded the video immediately after he recorded it to YouTube, so that sometimes those cameras get broken after videos are made, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Or erased. You know, there's some cases where I've seen a case where somebody has been, who's been videotaping, has been arrested by the police for illegal recording of private communications between them and dispatch, because they use their right. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, when the arrested person volunteers to erase that data, they're not arrested anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like there's certain pressures in that. So, you know, people and the citizens are put themselves at risk if they're videotaping stuff that could be damaging to anybody.
Yeah.
So it's just something to, what if anybody sees anything like this again, upload it to video
right away.
Upload it right away. So it's
now, in and along those that same respect, would there be any evidentiary, or I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase this, if the professor had gone home and hung on to it for a couple of days, could have that cast doubt onto the validity of the video?
Well, anybody could attack the validity of the video, you know, but I think it would be easy to establish that it was legitimate and not doctored. Like, you can always worry about it being doctored. That would be a tough video to doctor, like, you know, like putting into the hand of the police a baton, like, you know, or an axe. Like, and there is a second one that we're looking for. There was one from the alternate angle that that got onto the university website, but I haven't been able to get a copy of it.
Okay.
Because, and so I'm trying to get a copy of that, because you get it from both sides and it's helpful. So if anybody knows where I could get a copy, that would help. It would help Ernest out a lot for his trial.
Right. As I understand it, just as a rule of evidence, I believe that when you're entering something like video, you simply have the person who took the video swear to the accuracy and the validity of the video.
Yes.
So in this instance, the professor would actually just make an oath that it is as they took it. So that's an important point of evidence as well for trial.
And then you could have a voir dire on it where you just argue it in on the balance of probabilities that it's legitimate. But having worked with the Crown's office and the police, they're very reasonable.
Okay.
And the Crown is separate from the police, right? And I don't see them fighting it if on its face it looks like it's a legitimate video, unless there was a big issue. So,
Okay, great. Well, it was a very interesting case for us to discuss today. Thank you very much for meeting with us, and I'm sure listeners will have learned a great deal.
Yeah, pleasure.